Hey, and welcome to another episode of the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. This is Willem Vanderhorst, your host for the show. Okay, I am already late on schedule. There's like tons of things going on, and the days are too short for me to get all the things that I have in my schedule done on time, or I'm cramming way too much of them. It's probably a little bit more of the latter. But anyway, I have an exciting conversation right now. I keep repeating exciting. All right, so that's another foreshadowing, by the way. This episode took me a while to edit, and for whatever reason, there seemed to have been an issue with the audio track and the timing of it. So I had to spend a lot more time than usual. So I didn't miss anything, and the quality is fine, but I had to spend a lot more time aligning the conversation so they were not talking over each other. And I know that when we had the conversation, we were not talking over each other. So let's talk a little bit about the guests. I'm talking to Emma Rorolo. Wow, this is actually, I'm just realizing now this is difficult to say. Emma, if you listen to this, I apologize for butchering your name. Rorolo. Emma Rorolo. Emma Rorolo is from the UK, and she is the founder and chief creative officer of the Pineapple Lounge. The Pineapple Lounge is a research agency that's dedicated and works with kids, brands, entertainment, toys, anybody who's trying to target and understand and better connect with children, teenagers, all of Gen Z. And we talk about the generational gaps and generational differences in our podcast, and families overall. And parenting is also another conversation we really get into. She works with a lot of global brands, and we had a fantastic conversation. And I came across Emma I was on a discussion panel, online discussion panel and expert panel on this website called Current, about play and play and development. And Emma's really into play. And I was excited to find somebody who is in a similar space professionally in terms of working professionally with brands, doing marketing, communications, creative communications, in this case, research, and better understanding the trends going on, what's popular with teens, kids, toys, entertainment, play. And Emma also has a blog and Instagram account called The Playful Den. And we go over that in detail and talk about everything that she's got and everything she believes in terms of play, and having a playful state of mind, and having playful as a center of a life philosophy, basically. And so we had a fantastic time. The funny thing is I realized during the conversation, and I was cringing listening to it when I was editing, how much I keep repeating that I'm very excited to talk to her, and they're slightly embarrassed. How many ahs and ums, and I want to get better with that. Every time I think I'm not doing that much, I'm still doing a lot. And I'm rambling in the middle of my questions. We had a fantastic conversation. I think overall it works, but I don't think my questions were particularly clear. Maybe because that was just, I don't know, the topic gets me excited because, as you know, I'm really interested in play and games and integrating that in life overall, strategy in particular, and learning from play and games to put into different areas of life. So anyway, that's that for the guests. Just a little bit of the usual promo / housekeeping. If you're listening to this, it would be fantastic if you enjoy this in particular, if you give the show a rating and a review on the podcast, your favorite podcast app, wherever you're listening to this. You might be listening on a Apple podcast. It's like the bigger one, / iTunes. I believe on your iPhone and Apple podcast app, there's a way you can add a 5-star rating to the show. That helps a lot of other people find the show. It helps me be, you know, selfishly encouraged to say, oh, people are liking this. I should keep going. And even better, take a minute to write a review. You can also give me a shout out on Twitter. My handle is ICVillem, letters I, C, and Villem, WILLEM. The whole website to find everything and subscribe to the newsletter, the Ice Cream Sunday newsletter, where I talk about what I'm up to every week. And a couple of links I call the Ice Cream Combo, the Sunday Combo. It's two or three links that kind of like are not necessarily related, but I explain why I think they're particularly interesting together. That's everything on the website at icecreamforeveryone.net. ICE, everything spelled out basically, like ice cream, the cream, rather than seeing anything. And my email is, if you want to reach out to me, if you want to give me feedback, if you have questions, if you'd like to be on the show, if you want to find out about the work I do in brand strategy, I got some work going on at the moment, which is another reason I'm running behind with all of my editing, more than the recording, because the editing takes longer than recording. I'm recording with some fantastic guests. And anybody who's in the gaming and play space, we've got Emma now, but there's going to be more talk with game designers because I've been a little bit focused on the strategy side recently, which is not a bad thing. I mean, I like both, so hopefully you do. I don't know. Willem, W-I-L-L-E-M, at icecreamforeveryone.net. Everything spelled out. Give us a shout. Give us a rating or review. Like the page on Facebook. Subscribe to the podcast. Subscribe to the Facebook page. Get in touch if you want to find out. If you need work with your brand, if you want to find out about the workshops I do with playful elements, role-playing game mechanisms, board game mechanisms, and things like that. And that's about it. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy listening to the conversation I had with Emma. Hey, Emma, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. Very excited speaking to you. I, you know, after spending a bit of time looking at everything from your blog to the business that you're running to everything that you're up to, that seems to be play and games and families and working with brands with anything to do with communications, I get very excited, basically. But this is where I thought we'd start, because I looked at your Instagram and Pinterest and I was wondering, are you working from home right now?
I am.
So I was wondering if you could describe where you are right now. If it's anything to do with the photos I've seen, I think it's going to be an exciting way to start.
Yeah, so I basically live inside some kind of unicorn rainbow. I've been on a mission since we bought this house. I live down in the south coast in a little town called Bournemouth.
So the south coast of England, because a lot of the people listening are not necessarily in England.
Yeah, so the south coast of England, in a town called Bournemouth. It's very sort of British seaside, beach huts. And then I work out of London and New York when I'm not working at home. We moved down here 2 years ago, and the whole house was white. So it's a converted house. It's kind of been modernized. And it was just like this amazing blank canvas. So we've been going through every room for the last 2 years with embracing color and play through how we design our home. So right now I'm actually probably in the least inspiring room in the house, which is our bedroom. Okay. Because we've done everywhere else before. So this is kind of the last space to get the color treatment. So I have lots of plans for how that's going to happen. But this is probably the least colorful space so far.
What's the most colorful one so far?
So my daughter's room is based around the kawaii trend. We went on a trip to Japan a few years ago and spent a lot of time hanging out in Harajuku and just looking at all the like incredible trends and fashions and use of characters and colors and all these little kawaii kind of touches everywhere. And she was just captivated. So when we bought this house and we talked about the room and I designed it with her around how she plays and what she's interested in, she kept coming back to kawaii. So she has this...
Can you just describe kawaii for anybody who doesn't know the term?
Yeah, kawaii is the Japanese word for cute. And it's kind of like an aesthetic that they apply to characters and fashion and decor. And it's the use of cuteness, really, across everything. So her room has this really bold polka dot wallpaper with bright yellow circles against a white wallpaper. And then on the other wall, is the color that's the opposite end of the color spectrum to yellow, which is purple, has a sort of vivid kind of lavender colored wall. And you just walk in there and her bed is in the shape of a house, and she has this amazing long desk with these pegboards on the wall with all of her creative materials, and it's just like this explosion of kawaii and creativity.
Wow, that's very very cool, very exciting. What do you plan? Or do you already have plans set for the bedroom where you are, or in terms of color?
Yeah. So there's like a sort of a space where all the clothes are. I don't want to say walk-in wardrobe because that makes me sound like something that it's really not. But it has a sort of sloping ceiling, and I thought it would be really playful to actually wallpaper just that space, that entire little sort of, it's almost like a little cavern in there, and to do that with a really bold, playful wallpaper, and for that to be the only space in the room that has that, because I think I really like transforming dead spaces into like little magical corners, and I really like finding play and putting playfulness into places that, you know, might otherwise be sort of forgotten about or just kept as functional.
Yeah. Awesome. Great. Thank you. So, all right. Well, it's good you're talking about your daughter. Usually I like to go back after that and just go from the beginning. Where are you from, actually?
So I'm from the Midlands. So the closest city people might be familiar with would be Birmingham, which has a really strong accent. But I don't have that anymore through a career of presenting and working with international clients. I have quite a sort of a neutral accent. But yeah, I'm actually from Birmingham, right in the middle of England.
And I noticed just like browsing around, and I think I saw that on one of your websites, that you have or had a really strong interest for mermaids. And I was wondering when that started.
Yeah, I think I'm an Aquarius. I'm quite into star signs. And I think from just birth, really, I've always swam and been really confident in the water and had an interest in any kind of sport or activity that's involved water. So funnily enough, where I grew up, though, is the furthest place from the sea in the UK. So as soon as I possibly could, I was out the door on my gap year traveling, and just have always been pulled to live near the sea ever since, really. So, and now I live down here and I swim all year round in the sea. Obviously, in the summer, I can just go in normal swim gear, but I have a full body swimsuit, and I swim all through the year, even when it's freezing.
Wow, that's impressive. I live in Chicago, and the lake is really cold. And I mean, obviously it froze this winter. I've only been here for a couple of years, but so people swim in the summer, not really so much, although there's the thing called the polar plunge where everybody goes, and there's like a special event in the new year. But anyway, I barely go in the summer. I don't it's for me in the summer. So I'm impressed by the fact that you go with a suit in the winter.
It's really good for, I do it because I love the water, but actually for mental health. Like for me, it's such a powerful way to be still and to clear your mind. And when I get out of the sea, actually more so when it's cold than when it's warm, there's just like an immediate sense of joy. I think there's something about like shocking your body and doing something that is so natural, and being in a place that's just not really your environment, like the sea, that just completely resets your mind. So that's kind of why I do it now.
Yeah, I've heard that also from, you know, the kind of like high powered, like people like Tony Robbins, Tim Ferriss, do like cryo freeze or go like for very cold bathroom sets, things like that. I've heard about that. I think actually the Tim Ferriss show, Russell Brand, on Russell Brand's podcast, he just recently published a thing with a guy from Scandinavia, I think Finland, who does all sorts of work through bathing in cold, essentially, in very cold.
Yeah, I listened to that.
I haven't listened to it yet. I saw it like recommended on my YouTube. Is it worth listening to?
Yeah, I'm quite a big fan of Russell Brand. Yeah, he does. I can't remember what the guy's name is now, but there is some evidence that shows that cold water swimming, like if you suffer from things like depression, is more effective than medication. Like there is some proof in that. It's pretty magical.
Interesting. Cool. And how were you, how did you grow up, and how did you like to play as a kid yourself?
So I had a very free play childhood. So I'm a millennial, but quite an old millennial. So I'm kind of on the cusp of Gen X and millennial, but so I still had quite an analog childhood that was quite open, and at a time when playing on the street was very much the norm, and the street was ours. So the kids in the street, we own the street, and if a car came down the street, then they moved out the way for us. So we were very much like owned that street, and it had a brook, which is like a small little stream at the end of the street, and that's kind of where we spent most of our time, in and out of each other's houses, on our bikes, fishing. Yeah, very, very analog, and quite now, in comparison to modern childhood, quite kind of wholesome, and kind of natural and outdoorsy.
Yeah. And was this more of a kind of countryside, suburban city environment, or?
Yeah, kind of, it's, I wouldn't say countryside, but I would say quite close to lots of natural environments, fields and parks, and that kind of thing. But it was a town where I grew up.
Okay. And do you have siblings?
I have one older brother.
What were your parents doing? Or what do they do? I don't know.
Yeah. So they're both, so I'm quite unique in my family, in that I've become this kind of business lady and work in the commercial sector with brands and marketing. My parents are both work for the NHS, which is the health service over here in the UK. My mum is a radiographer and is still in the industry. And my dad, he's now retired, but he was a maxillofacial technician, which means that he makes prosthetics for people's faces that have had issues with them, like burns victims or cancer patients, and he basically like makes eyes and ears and things like that.
Wow. All right. And so you're talking about marketing and brands. I think you studied the communications in university, right?
Yeah, I went to university actually here where I live now. So I've sort of come back and studied advertising and marketing.
What got you interested in studying that in the first place? How did that come about?
Yeah, so growing up, I always wanted to be a journalist or a presenter. So I kind of followed the kind of media route. And I went into this degree, honestly, because I didn't really know what else to do. And people were like, oh, it's really quite difficult to get onto this course. You have to be quite creative. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to go and try and do that. And I wanted to live by the sea. And, you know, the university was down here by the beach, and I thought that'd be pretty sweet to go to uni by the sea. And I was also interested in originally in being maybe being a creative. So a person that actually came up with adverts. So that's kind of what I started.
Did you think of yourself as creative before, and what, like before going to university or after, or?
Yeah. So I think this is really fascinating. And I think, no, I don't think I did. And now I'm fully embracing of, you know, the sort of creative side of myself in every aspect. But I think the time when I grew up, unless you were really good at drawing, you weren't really seen as creative. And I'm not particularly good at drawing. I'm not particularly good at technical drawings or diagram or anything like that. So I think I was quite steered away from that. And I was very, very good at English and super into reading. So I was kind of always like nudged into writing type pathways. And I think that's because when I went to school, you know, they didn't really know what jobs were out there. No one could really advise you on that. So I don't think I did actually see myself as a creative person, even though now when I look back, like I was doing some really wacky things, like with my clothes and customization. And
like what, for example?
So like I would never wear a pair of jeans or a skirt without doing something to it. I used to like put them in bleach and like cut them and put cheese graters over them to give the material a texture, and all these like really like now when I think back, I'm like, God, it was just pouring out of me. But even then I didn't consider myself as like artistic or creative, because I'd sort of gone to school with this sense that creative people draw. That's what creative people do.
Yeah, it's funny because I had the same kind of, I think I had a little bit of the same kind of experience. I'm not particularly good at drawing. I did took like classes at some point when I was a kid. And then, but then I did read a lot and I was pushed towards, not pushed towards, because my parents really let me do whatever I wanted. But in the end, and now anyway, I think writing and words are a lot more my thing than drawing. But
Yeah, it's interesting now because obviously I've got my own children, and I think as kind of modern parents, I think we're on the lookout for, like, you know, what are their strengths and what are the little things that bubble up, and we try and foster them and, you know, present opportunities to do that. And I think on reflection, I think if I'd have had that, or if, you know, teachers and careers people would have been perhaps more aware of what was out there, I think my creativity probably would have been spotted at some point. And I may have ended up going down more of like a design path, which is something that really interests me now. And actually is something that I have quite a lot of natural skills in, but never would have ever thought to have gone down that route, which is quite interesting.
Mm, got it. All right. So back, so you completed communications, and you're at that point while studying it, did that come up as like, oh, that's definitely the kind of career I want to go into?
I don't think I really knew. I funnily enough, we did qualitative research we did market research as one of the parts of the course. And that was the part that interested me the least. And that was the thing that I went into. And I think that's partly because we obviously studied the discipline in quite a kind of linear way. And then when I went out into the industry and I got to see the application of insight, I was like, wow, this is actually really cool. And I did after university, I did a placement while I was traveling in Australia at a market research agency, and got to work side by side some really senior people in the agency, and could see how they were applying insight in this really strategic and quite creative way. And that just piqued my interest. So I just followed that and went straight into qualitative research after university.
All right. So for people who don't know, could you explain qualitative research and maybe explain like the what you saw as traditional and what you saw as more creative, and maybe how you're doing it now?
Yeah. So I think when you hear the words market research, you think questionnaires, people on the street with clipboards.
Clipboards are very important.
People behind the mirror, you know, sat in a circle, answering questions in quite a dull way. And what I saw was out there were things like ethnography, where you can go and hang out with people and study their behavior. I saw cultural analysis, so how you can study what's happening in pop culture and in things like language and trends and those sorts of things, and bring that into the work to help explain why people do what they do. And really, qualitative research is all about the study of human behavior. And when you say it like that, that's quite different to what you think of when you hear market research, I think.
Yeah, no, it is, absolutely. And so you started your own market research agency?
Yeah. So so my background was in qual, and I got a good grounding there. And then I quite quickly started to specialize in children's brands because I had quite a natural skill to be able to communicate with young people, and I was interested in that sector. So after I'd worked in London for a bit and I'd been at a few agencies, I actually went on maternity leave. I was 27. When I had my first child, Phoenix, he's 9 this year. And when I was on maternity leave, I actually had like a real huge surge of creativity. And rather than slowing down, I actually ramped up. I started blogging. I blogged my whole end of pregnancy and first year of motherhood. And actually that gave me, in a way, it gave me a voice, and it gave me a confidence that I, you know, I still kind of had a lot to offer, and that my creative energy was still there. So I didn't go back to my job. I started being an independent, a freelancer, working directly for clients and other agencies. And that's when I decided I would just set that up as a business and take it from there. So I actually started my agency, the Pineapple Lounge, when I was 27 years old and when I had a 6-month-old baby.
Wow. And when you're blogging and writing about your experience of pregnancy and the first few year towards birth, was that sharing the experience of how that was for you, or was there any other kind of theme alongside of it?
Yeah, it was called Mission to Motherhood, and it was kind of like around this idea of trying to figure out how you become a mum, and it was a lot about particularly about identity, I think, and how your identity shifts and how to, I think, retain who you are, even when you enter a new life stage, and to be able to do that with confidence and not to kind of get bogged down in the minutiae of the parenting world.
And I'm sure there's a lot that's covered inside of the blog, but like now it's been, obviously a few years. Was there anything in particular that there was... I was looking for the right word, whether it's remarkable or noticeable or like something that sums up the whole experience of how motherhood was for you, I guess. And like, what changes did you see in yourself or non-changes, I guess?
Yeah.
It's a bit of an open question.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because I think my experience is quite different because I managed to start this company and actually go on this new career path, whereas I think for a lot of women they feel like they've become disconnected from themselves and from their careers in particular. And maybe it's because I was so conscious of that, because at the point where I had my first child, I was at a point where most people would think that's really risky, a point in your career to do that, because I was kind of reaching quite a senior level, and I was getting known in the industry and having my own clients and that sort of thing. And I think that kind of drove me to keep the momentum going. And I think for me, like, I had quite good perspective right from the beginning, because I just found it so incredible that I could grow a human and birth to it and keep it alive. And for it to come out being this like amazing little thing, that it kind of made everything seem less scary. Like, there really is nothing more amazing or incredible than that. And it actually gave me quite a fearlessness to just go out and just try stuff out. And if it didn't matter, I've still got this cool little thing back at home and I'd figure it out. So I kind of really, I think, tried to hold on to. After labor, like, you have this incredible feeling of like, oh my God, I just did this like insane thing. And I really tried to hold on to that to kind of drive me to do whatever it was that I wanted to do.
Awesome. And just like one thing that you were mentioning before, but I just wanted to track back on it slightly. So you'd already gone in the direction of working with kids brands or family brands. How did that come about? Was it a bit per chance, or it sounded like a natural interest, but I was curious.
Definitely a bit of both, like a natural interest, because previously, like, I'd always worked in like leisure centers and as a pool lifeguard, and I'd always done like summer camps with kids. And I think when I was at like my first few agencies, I was asked to moderate with kids literally because I was the youngest person on the team. So I think that's how it started. And then I was like, this is so much more interesting because, in the analysis and in the study of their behavior, you're not only looking at how they're reacting to this brand and this particular packaging, but you have to consider, what developmental stage are they at? What is the context of the childhood that they're having in terms of, devices and technology and access to things that maybe children didn't have in previous generations. What's kind of going on with their family structure? Because, to understand a child, you also really need to understand how they're being parented and the relationships that they have with the key role models in their lives. So I just found it so much more to say so much more to look around the project than some of the things that I was doing on more kind of straightforward adult brands.
And so now, a few years later, you got the Pineapple Lounger agency. So now, how do you work with brands now? Presumably, I mean, from what I understand, well, yeah, please just give us a little bit of the overview, I guess.
Yeah. So this is the 9th year of running the business. We're a team of 12 across London and New York. And we started really as an agency to embrace this new generation. So Generation Z. So they're kind of aged around 8 to around early 20s. And when I started the business, I knew that these kids were going to be so different to any other generation that we've seen. And I know that we say that every generation that comes up, but these are the first to have a full digital childhood. So millennials are often described as digital natives, but they're not. Most millennials did have an analog childhood, and their first experiences with tech were pretty playful and pretty amateur compared to what these kids have had. So I knew these kids' context was going to be completely unique because of where they had entered the planet on the tech revolution timeline. So I designed the agency based on that, saying, you know, we're still researching them in the same way, and we can't do that. We have to adapt. We're still thinking about them in quite a kind of academic developmental way, and we need to lean much more into popular culture and the kind of messages and narratives that they are immersed in, because they are different now. So that was kind of how it started. It was built for Gen Z, about them, and to help brands look at the world through their eyes.
And so do you tend to work directly with brands like consumer insights and research teams on the brand and marketing side, or also with creative or marketing agencies, or a bit of both? Or
bit of both, yeah. So a lot of our clients are from insight teams, but we also work very closely with marketeers, brand managers, and also products and innovation teams as well.
Oh, cool. That's really interesting. And so also qualitative as well as quantitative, or?
Yeah, so we describe ourselves as method neutral. So we will choose the tools for the brief and whatever works best. We have what's called a hack squad, which is a global collective of Gen Z and millennial parents. And they are really there to open doors for us into worlds that we wouldn't ordinarily have access to. So they are vloggers and bloggers and change makers and opinion leaders in spaces like fashion and beauty and gaming and esports and coding and education. And they are all over the world. It's completely unique. There's about 35 of them now. It's a small but selected group. So there's quite a rigorous recruitment process. And we are using them to idea source, to predict the future, to come up with concept ideas, and to really provide insight that is more cutting edge from perhaps what you might get from speaking to more mainstream consumers.
It's interesting. And I also noticed that you had one of the things you have going on, and I watched a video, or at least presented on the website, with this idea of following what cool and fun is to either children or teenagers. Yeah. And I was wondering, in your experience, because cool, I mean, this is a fascinating research. I think it's really interesting. But I was wondering if cool changes, or how frequently it changes, like what kind of trends go on. Does it tend to change from a generation's perspective, or is it something that changes everything every time there's a new fad? Or
yeah,
are the words and things used consistent with like one kid or an area or years? I don't know. What's your experience so far of that? How often does it change?
Yeah. So with cool, there's kind of like layers. So the fundamental essence of what cool means, which we would describe as something that is magnetic, that draws people to it and makes them want to use it to express who they are to other people. That hasn't changed. And that's kind of still what people say when they mean something's cool. But how cool presents itself changes all the time. and it is impacted by generations. So if you think about Gen X, Cool then was really all about, it was very tribal. So it was kind of identifying with subcultures and really expressing yourself in a way that communicated to other people that you were part of a particular tribe. And that was cool to you. That was magnetic to you. And that expressed something about who you are to other people by your connectivity to the tribe that you belong to. When we move on to millennials, they were much more about individuality. So that was all about standing out and being unique. And so cool things to them were things that made them probably still fit in, but also pointed to their nuances, to their individual traits. And now when we come on to Gen Z, we see a real, what we would describe as participatory culture. So they want to join in with things that make them feel connected in quite a global way to their generation. So this is why we have viral and dance movements and games that kind of pique their interest across the world. They want to like join in on these movements, and they advocate for things. So they align themselves with causes that define their values and who they think they are. So these generational shifts in kind of how you want to define yourself and how you form identity have a massive impact on what things you think are cool and how you define things that are cool to you.
Thank you. That's awesome. Very, very cool. And how did the, so as you started working with children, families, brands, which presumably, actually, I don't know, so I'm not going to presume. How did the idea of studying play come into this? Was it always included, or did it come a little bit later? Because you also have a blog, and I want to talk about it, called The Playful Den.
Yes.
And that's also your Instagram and your Pinterest that are like gorgeous boards. And, you know, so that's something I want to talk about as well. And was that always parallel with the idea of developing the Pineapple Lounge and including play within your research, or?
Yeah, I think when children and youth are your business, there are three things that come up pretty much in every single brief. How can my brand be cool? How can my brand be fun? How can I encourage playfulness? And those are the things that just come up time and time again. It doesn't really matter if we're working on a streaming platform, on a collectible toy, or a lunchbox snack. There's always an element of those three things in the mix.
And I was wondering, is the third one on play, is that the case for brands and services that are already like entertainment and toys by nature, or also ones that are, I don't know, like a fruit juice or something, like, you know, that is addressed, that is wanting to sell to families and children, but is not necessarily playful or toy in itself?
Yeah, if you can inject play into your experience, generally, and this is for any age, it's more sticky, it's more memorable, and it's more time worthy. And you know, particularly for us, we're working with kids and youth. Play is their language. Play is their how they are meant to be in terms of their state of mind. And when you can get someone into a play state, that's a phenomenal place to put them in, because you become time worthy, you become engaging, you probably become more talkable. So putting people into this kind of this playful mindset is really powerful from a branding point of view.
Yeah, and what have you found, and what are some of the, I don't know, anything that you use to encourage people to be in a play state of mind? And I know it might be, I don't know if it's easier or more difficult with children versus teens or adults.
Yeah. So I started The Playful Den because I wanted to talk about this lifestyle philosophy of living playfully. So we've seen in kind of contemporary culture, things like yoga and mindfulness and digital detoxing kind of really becoming a lot more mainstream as a way to cope with the complexities and busyness and pressure of modern life. From my point of view, play is way more effective than any of them and should be up there with them or above them. And I think if everyone played more, the world would be an entirely different place. As humans, a playful mind state is kind of how we're meant to be. But we sort of associate play with childhood only. And even in childhood, it's almost like a luxury or a nice to have now because things have become so timetabled and scheduled. So I wanted to start this blog and this Instagram to sort of remind people of how important play is and how it's not just about toys. So I talk about how you can have this playful way of looking at everything in your life, from how you parent to how you form relationships to how you decorate your home to how you put your clothes on every day. Like, you can apply the principles of play everywhere. And this leads to things that people want, which is escapism and relaxation and a kind of a calming down and happiness and a good well-being. It does all of these things really effectively.
I absolutely agree. And this is awesome. It's part of the reason I was really excited to talk to you. And actually, this is a great place. I was wondering if we'd have a chance to have this topic, but this is a starting question that I want to explore. And just as you said, we lose the idea of play growing up, and even more and more children already like don't have much space for it.
Yeah.
And humans have started opposing the idea of work and play, which were not words that were opposed in the first place. I don't think they're actually mutually exclusive either. But I was wondering what your experience or opinion was about this idea that we put play and work as opposed words, but they don't really necessarily, I think they don't have to be, but I don't know what you think.
I agree. Yeah. I think we have this weird sort of obsession with moving on and growing up and defining, you know, I'm in this environment now, or I'm in this life stage now. And in that process, play just gets completely diluted often. And it starts, doesn't it, in the sort of teen years and the early kind of adult years, where, you know, maybe you still really enjoy doing something that's playful, but suddenly you have to put that down because maybe you're too old for that now. But it's probably a time when you need it even more. And I think that's what I see in kind of modern childhood, is that children have never needed unstructured play more than they do now, and yet they've never had less of it.
It's true. I mean, having lived, I think it's probably increasingly the case in Europe and in the States. I don't know about the States, but I know that in Asia, and having lived in Singapore and traveled around, that the schedule and the timetable that children have is impressive. They're scheduled down, like before they can even walk, they're studying.
Yeah.
To the hour. And
my
older brother, I don't have children, but all my siblings do. And my older brother lives in Sri Lanka. And my nephew's in a very cool school, but still, you know, he's learning to write and read and has exams. And he was four. He's just turned five last week. And I was like, I was just thinking, did I have exams when I was four? I was like, I don't think I had exams.
Yeah.
And they were called exams, just the word and the environment, right? So with grades and you know, the pressure on the child to perform, and I think I was just playing with cubes and just beginning to write and just shape. I don't know, like,
yeah, completely. I mean, here, particularly here in the UK, I have no idea why we expect and want children to know what they know and do academically at the young ages that they do. I see no benefit to some of the skills that they learn at school, the academic schools, academic skills. I see no benefit to why they learn them so early.
Oh, I have another question. I was just, this comes up, I wasn't really thinking about this in my preparation, but I have several friends in the UK, because I lived in London for 8 years, who homeschool their children. I was wondering if you had a perspective on, you know, education and homeschooling in different ways, or if this is something you looked at, or...
Yeah, I think it's on the rise, for sure. And it's sort of one of the fringe trends that we talk about. And the reason that it is because, I think parents, and particularly millennials actually, are really focused on EQ versus IQ, and EQ as almost like this answer to the future, versus all of these kind of IQ based curriculums that aren't really going to give kids the skills that they need to learn to fix the problems in the world and to do the jobs that we don't even know exist yet when they're older. And the schools here in the UK, I think the same is true in the States. I think the same is true in some places in Europe. The focus is on linear learning and kind of like erodes a child's imagination rather than growing it with age.
Actually, talking about imagination, there was a couple of posts that just struck my attention that are recent posts. I read a few of the recent posts you have in your blog, and I'll add all the links in the show notes, but I recommend checking it out. It's cool. Talking about imaginative play, and you wrote this interesting post about open-ended style toys versus ones that are licensed, which I imagine that those are things that you work on. So, I was just wondering like, if you could tell us a little bit about that that post you wrote, an open-ended toy.
Yeah. So I've been really fascinated that on Instagram, a sort of high trend level, a lot of the Montessori style open-ended toys are super trendy to share and quite desirable, partly because they look beautiful. They are aesthetically stunning the way that they're designed, but also because people are turning towards this idea of open-ended play, and this is becoming more known, I think, in the parenting community. And what open-ended play means is that it's more about giving kids tools and objects and props and things that they have to fill in the blanks with. So it's almost like a blank canvas. So when they build with these things or when they use these things, they are seeing whatever it is that they imagine. This is really different to getting, say, a playset from your favorite TV show, which comes out the box with a predefined story, a group of characters that have their gender defined, that have their personality defined, that have their behaviors defined. So you are playing not with a blank canvas, you're playing in a world that someone else has imagined for you. I don't believe that one is kind of better than the other, or that, you know, one is bad and one is good. I think there's space for both, but the way that these children are entering the world is actually in quite a commercial way, and is they have really early experience of these character franchise brands pretty much from as soon as they can speak and watch a screen. They're very used to I see a character here. I expect to see it in a toy, in an app, on my food, on my potty, like everywhere, because of the licensing model. So the point I was making in this post is I think children, modern children, I think they're not as good at doing that blank canvas play, because right from an early age, they play within pre-existing narratives and within characters that have been created by someone else.
Yeah. And I was wondering also reading it, and if you think, and this is like also to do with, well, I think maybe a little bit of a difference with the Gen Z and the newer generations, as you said, is it is across the board from the very beginning to have all of these licenses, characters, worlds that are there, which I love very much as well, but I don't know what kind of impact it's going to have. Like growing up myself, and I'm, you know, I'm from 79, so I'm like at the end of Gen X, before millennial sort of thing. But I grew up with those characters. I mean, and I had, you know, Transformers and other licensing kind of toys, but I also had cubes and just imaginative play that didn't have anything attached to it. I played with both. And looking at those very beautiful kind of Montessori style toys, and I looked at some of the links you had in the post that are really like beautiful, designy, you know, Scandinavian nature. I was wondering if some of those, and the price tag is more expensive. So does that limit the access to a wider audience, or well, because technically, like, if they're just cubes, they're just, they're not worth anything. So I don't know. I was just wondering, is there something a little bit class-based or money-based or social-based to be able to access those kinds of things or not?
Unfortunately, I think there is. I think you can still get these things at an affordable price point. But I think when it comes to buying toys, I do think that characters and licenses bring a value. And I do think that they really drive purchase behavior. And particularly, you know, parents who are buying toys often in reaction to child requests, the kids will be responding to what they see in their content a lot. So a kid isn't going to say, oh, I'd really like some wooden shapes that I can just build and imagine something with. Like, a kid is never going to say that. And I think we are a culture that is obsessed with kids being happy. And we kind of chase this idea of happiness all the time. And that makes it very difficult because happiness is transient. You can't be happy all the time. And I think that's how parents approach buying things for their children, particularly when it comes to play and toys. It's quite different to, like, when you think about food, when generally most people are like, you know, I need to get a bit of this and a bit of that and you know, kind of make sure it's balanced. I don't think that's always the way that a lot of parents see play. They think, what's going to make the kid happy and what are they into? And if they're being child-led, that's going to be characters and licenses and franchises. And I like want to be clear that I'm not against that. Like, my whole family is obsessed with Harry Potter. And we have so much of that stuff. My husband and my son are massive Star Wars fans, like super into the fandom communities. But from a kind of point of view of setting up a play environment and a play experience, I don't think most parents go into it thinking about that. They go into it from the point of view of instant gratification and happiness of what the child will react to.
Yeah, I really like the idea of thinking about it like a balanced diet, that there's different styles of play and, like, make sure that you have. So for you, what do you think the different styles of play or different kinds of toys or games make up a good balance or a good diet?
Yeah, so I'm actually really into being led by the child and designing the environment from them, really. So my daughter is super into creative art. So I set her room up whereas one whole wall is a desk because so she can have the space to use all different creative materials and kind of things like that. And there's much more of that in her room than there is of say, like, you know, sort of out of the box toys like figures and dolls and things like that. So I think that's great. I think the experiences like that that are limitless are also really important. So there's no boundaries to that type of play, you know, and play is so powerful when it goes to another place and then another place and another place. That's when you really get into a flow state. So I try and look for experiences that can go to other places, and creative arts is a really good one. And I'm super into, like, the slime making and bath bomb making and all of that stuff I love. My son is, like, really adventurous and outdoorsy. So he does a lot of parkour, free running, and he's really into, like, woods and things like that. So he actually, I cleared out our kind of shed thing in the garden and put a station in there, and he's into, like, whittling.
I don't know and, what that is.
Has, like, it's like with a pen knife where you get, you kind of, you skin sticks almost to make them smooth, and he carves like bows and arrows and things like that. So an element of risk for him is what attracts him to playful experiences. So I try and look for ways to bring that in without him ending up in A&E.
Yes. Cool. So we'll just slowly wrap up, but I was wondering what, because I'm interested in this whole themes and everything that we're talking about. And I'm expecting you studied a little bit. Are there any books that you particularly recommend around play, games, creativity?
Yeah, so I'm reading this book at the moment called Joyful, which is by Ingrid Fettel Lee, who's the former design director of IDEO in New York. And the book is about how you can kind of get joy out of everyday design. So it's kind of about, like, when you decorate a space or you bring a color into a space or you have a particular item that's designed in a way that's really attractive to you, how that can actually affect your mood and behavior. So this is really fascinating to me because it has a direct correlation to what I kind of talk about in terms of how play can make you think and feel. But it's a fascinating book. And one of the stories that she tells in it is there's this town, I can't remember where it is now, but it's a town that is like really in decline. And there's loads of crime, like it's bad times there. And a new mayor comes in and he paints all of these buildings like vivid orange and yellow and just transforms a city that's like brown and grey into like a colourful space, using particular shades of colour purposefully. So like orange, for example, is the colour of creativity. And this town like transforms itself. The crime rate goes down. People's income goes up, the way that they feel about living there changes, and the overall happiness of the people changes. And this is just from changing the design of the environment that's around them. So I thought that was really fascinating.
That is very cool. Super interesting. All right, I'll have to check it out. Cool. I usually complete the conversations with what I'm calling the cool down questions, just a few kind of rapid fire, and I'm testing a few new ones, starting on the easy one because it's the Ice Cream for Everyone podcast. Do you have a favorite ice cream flavor?
Do you know what? I actually really just like the Mr. Whippy that comes out of the machine with a flake in it. Like, I don't want to know what's in that ice cream.
But it's sugar.
Yeah. But it's like, it's nostalgic and it's just, yeah, it's like happy memories, joyful.
Yeah, it's funny, on the same kind of line, not exactly ice cream though. So I've been living in the US for 2 years now, and I hadn't bought a pack of Oreo cookies. I just don't really, I do sweets, but some sweet stuff, but I don't really buy cookies or biscuits. But I did yesterday, and I do like cookies and cream as an ice cream flavor, which is like, you know, with Oreo cookies inside. Anyway, long story short, I tried these cookies with a little bit of milk, which I don't usually drink either. They essentially have the flavor of Oreos. I just realized is sugar on sugar is essentially what it tastes like. It's actually quite funny. It's like, wow. And that's going to, anyway, it's, I thought it's interesting.
Yeah. I love
what we get excited as kids. And even just there, I was like, oh, what if I just got a pack of biscuits? And yeah. Anyway, do you play games? Is there a game you enjoy and recommend playing?
So my husband is a massive retro tech collector. So we have like the first Atari, we have an N64, and we have a Mega Drive. And I was really into Sonic when I was a kid, Sonic the Hedgehog. And now we have like an old TV, so we can play it on there. So that's quite fun.
Awesome. Very, very cool. I saw that there's been controversy around the, I think it's the movie animation coming out and the way that Sonic looked on the pop culture trivia.
I also really love geocaching. We do that as a family quite a lot. So on the app where you can go and find the treasures, that is such a good idea and such a brilliant thing to do with kids or with friends. We love that.
Yeah, that is very cool. My little brother and sister live in the south of France, and my brother and his wife do that with their kids.
Yeah, nice.
They go and explore and look for treasures. Yeah. And is there a website usually for it, or?
It's an app, so it's all done on the app. I've never been on the website.
Okay, cool. All right, so just to make sure I have the right thing for people to look up on the show notes.
Yeah.
Actually, talking about notes, this is another question. I was wondering, do you take notes usually while you're working? And if yes, how so?
Oh. I do. I still like a notepad.
What kind of notepad
and
do you use?
A pen. And I really like one that looks absolutely bonkers. The one I've got at the moment. The one I've got at the moment is it looks like it's been designed by David Bowie. It's full glitter. It's blue glitter with a big glittery lightning bolt through it. And my last one was covered in mermaid scales.
That's awesome. Is it like large, small? Does it have lines?
lines, yes. I'm not adverse to a plane. I quite like a plane as well. And I also had for my team, I had them made these huge like desk pads that we all have that are like Pineapple Lounge branded, and they have different spaces on them that say like ideas, must do, random thoughts. And I quite like those too.
That's pretty cool. All right. Thank you. What's the last piece of art or media that had an impact on you?
Into the Spider-Verse, which is the new Spider-Man animation. This film is off the hook. I'm quite hard to impress because I work in the kids industry, and because I'm always trying to push brands to take more risks, be more disruptive, like inspire kids in ways that we've never seen before. And this is the first time I've seen a kids film where I thought, wow, they get it. The style of it is incredible. The music is amazing. The characters have light and dark in them, which is really unusual for a kid's piece of animation. It's normally like the goodies, the baddies, evil, good. And this is really, you know, you don't really know who you're meant to like. And, you know, the characters have a mix of light and dark in them. And aesthetically, it is stunning. And I was so happy that it won the Oscar. It's the first time that Pixar haven't won the animation Oscar for a long time. And it was so deserved because I just thought it was incredibly on point.
I absolutely agree. I loved that film. I went to see it at the cinema and I was blown away by everything that you said. And also the other thing that I really loved and entirely deserved for the Oscar as well. I loved the mixed animation.
Yeah.
I love the mixed styles of animation, and that each one of the characters had their animation universe, I guess, that the kind of Japanese robot manga was in a very Japanese style, and that there was 3D and that there was drawing and there was modern. It really felt like today, New York, I guess.
Totally. And I mentioned earlier how, I like open-ended play experiences. And this is an example of how they've taken that into a piece of content. Because when you're in that world, it feels limitless and it feels like there's no boundaries. And that's, I think, how kids want to play. And that's how they see the world. And that's the first piece of film content that I've thought really, really captured that.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. All right, last question. If you had, you could give one thing to everybody, like you had a wish to make and you make the wish and everybody has that thing, what might that be?
I would give them a playroom. I would give them a room that was like designed and set up for their exact style of play. So play is anything that is done just for fun, that is done with curiosity, with passion, with openness and with freedom. And whatever that looks like, I would give everyone their own personal space so they could just go in there and be playful.
That's awesome. That's great. And actually what you just said about play and the definition was brilliant as well, because I think sometimes, or maybe many times, I don't know, people, I think with the thing of growing up and being a little bit more serious and, you know, the idea that you kind of need to leave childhood behind, maybe people think that play means a lot of, you know, bright colors, which it can, but it doesn't necessarily have to, I don't think.
Yeah.
Play can be different for different people.
People think that play is toys, and sometimes toys can be really unplayful and kind of, you know, not always the best stimulus for everyone for play. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do in my blog as well, is reconnect everyone with what is their play state? What does that look like to them, and do more of it?
Very cool. Awesome. This was fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, Emma. So before we go, just making sure that people know where to find you. Where can they look you up online and look for the Pineapple Lounge?
PineappleLounge.com and on Instagram, the_playful_den. And the blog is theplayfulden.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Lovely to chat to you.
All right, that's another episode wrapping up. Thank you so much. I appreciate you giving your entire time. I thought it was a fantastic conversation with Emma. You tell me what you thought. Tell me what you thought by hopefully giving me a 5-star review and a bit of a rating on the show. Give a shout out, share it with your friends. And that's about it for now. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon, morning, night, whatever time of day or night it is for you. All right, cheers. Bye.